and the Education Hour talking about validation tonight. And I did get a couple comments back about that there was what I went over last week was a bit confusing. And that's exactly right, because that's what we're discussing about this. There is no cut and dried, clear group of cases that specify exactly what validation is. And that's one of the problems that we're dealing with these various courts. So I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody now, and we'll go over this, and then we'll open things up for Q&A after that, and we'll pick it up from there. So anyway, as I was saying, the situation with the validation, there's been a variety of court cases, and of course one that we've discussed some, and it's a problem because it was almost like in my opinion, a stupid off-the-cuff comment by the court, which is Chaudhry versus Galarizo, where they said it's nothing more than somebody stating that a debt is owed, which is nonsense. That was not the intent. And one of the things that is in the NCLC books here that is very valuable that they touch on in certain areas where there is some of this controversy is, what is the legislative intent? Because we got to remember, where do these laws come from? They come from the legislature, and these committees that draft these laws have discussions, and there's information that you can go and find. And you can see what they discussed and what their intent was. And in fact, as Jeff has pointed out, that's what you find when you look at the annotated statutes. When you look at statutes, you get some information. When you look at the annotated statutes, that's where you find out what the intent was of the legislature in coming up with that law and implementing it. So anyway, I'm gonna go through this, and again, like I say, some of this stuff is contradictory, and there's a ton of case citations here, but I'm not going to read a lot of this. Where things are pertinent to something, a definite point, I will go ahead and give some case citations on that, but I'm not going to just go into this because there's tons of them. I mean, literally there's hundreds of them. And that's overkill. I know you don't want to sit and listen to that, so we're not going to do that. And I'm going to hope that my eyes will continue to work here. They are giving me fits again. They have been giving me fits. I'm having some pretty severe problems with my eyes. But I'm going to do the best I can. All right, picking up where I left off last week, the court noted that the easiest course for a debt collector was to simply wait until the end of the 30-day debt verification request period to serve a debt collection suit on the consumer. If the debt collector could not wait, and I can't imagine where that would come in, the best practice would be to provide two more notices to the consumer. And this was when we were discussing, them filing suit before the 30 days is up that the consumer has to demand validation of a debt. The first additional notice should be with the initial verification rights notice to the consumer and explain that the consumer's right to verification continues even if the debt collector sues the consumer during the 30-day verification request period. The second additional notice should be sent to the consumer at the time the summons and complaint is served and explain that the consumer still has the right to obtain debt verification from the debt collector and that the consumer additionally should respond appropriately in the state court as set out in the summons. In other words, respond through that as well as to the attorney. And it just like we've talked about what's on Jesse's site, you dispute, when you put a dispute in, if you've been sued, You put a dispute into the court case. You always do that. The safe harbor established in the Second Circuit by this decision will not necessarily be adopted by the other circuits. Now, see, this is one of the things that those of you that are fairly new to the legal system want to understand, is just because something is done in one place doesn't mean it's guaranteed that it has to be done everywhere. That's not the way it works. Each one of the circuits, which is those are the groupings of the federal courts, simplistic description of it, around the country. I'll read that again. The safe harbor established in the Second Circuit by this decision will not necessarily be adopted by the other circuits, such as the Fifth, where I am, or the Ninth in California, stuff like that. The best and simplest practice is to provide the verification rights notice well before initiating litigation. In addition to diminishing confusion, this allows the collector to hear and evaluate the consumer's defenses to and disputes of the debt collector's claim before the debt collector invests in drafting a debt collection suit and pays court filing and service fees. It provides the debt collector with more certainty and routinization of the timing of the notice. Besides that, it's just plain common sense. And it avoids the potential of the consumer confusion noted in Ellis by the Seventh Circuit in Thomas versus Law Firm of Simpson, S-I-M-P-S-O-N, and Cyback, spelled C-Y-B-A-K. And that is a Seventh Circuit case from 2004, just for your notes. When the consumer receives the verification rights notice about the same time as the summons in the debt collection suit. The basic approach of Section 1692G, parens A, was first contained in the 1976 House of Representatives Bill, H.R. 11969, and was refined in subsequent major bills. Now, see, there's a history to this. It goes back to 76. The phrase, quote, unless the following information is contained in the initial communication, unquote, was added by S.656, that's the legislature, and the phrase, quote, or the consumer has paid the debt, unquote. Many of the major debt collection bills required inclusion of the name and address of the original creditor in the notice of verification rights. The requirement of providing information on request was decided by the Senate Consumer Affairs Subcommittee. Okay. Now, there is a exception here for certain legal notices. The 2000 amendment to Section 1692G states, notice provisions. This is E. This is 1692GE. The sending or delivery of any form or notice which does not relate to the collection of a debt and is expressly required by the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, Title V of Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, or any provision of federal or state law relating to notice of data security breach or privacy, or any regulation prescribed under any such provision of law, shall not be treated as an initial communication in connection with the debt collection for purposes of this section. So if you get stuff related to the debt collection, stuff that's IRS related, that's not an initial communication. The most likely tax code notice in the debt collection context is an IRS Form 1099, notice of forgiven indebtedness as possibly taxable income. And we've had some discussion about this, of course. However, a 1099 notice may still trigger debt verification rights. Now listen to this carefully. However, a 1099 notice may still trigger debt verification rights if it was not, quote, required, unquote, such as when the consumer is insolvent, disputed the debt, discharged the debt in bankruptcy, or if the collector continued to collect the debt. The notice's exemption becomes irrelevant if the notice is sent with a request for payment, as a request for payment triggers the Section 1692G requirements. Where a Graham-Leach-Bliley Act notice misrepresented the consumer's Section 1692C parens B privacy protections, it was deceptive, violating the FDCPA. And I'm going to give you a couple case citations on this. Ruth versus Triumph, T-R-I-U-M-P-H, Partnerships. Say, Seventh Circuit decision from 2009. And then there's Hernandez versus Midland Credit Management, Inc. And that's the Northern District of Illinois, September of 2007. Under those circumstances, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act notice may not be expressly required under Section 1692GE and may act as a trigger for the Section 1692G notice requirements. All right. Now, here, let's talk about the statutory requirements of the verification notice. An incomplete statement of the section 1692GA 1-5 information violates the act. In other words, go and look at your frequently violated FDCPA guidelines and look up 1692GA 1-5. Those are absolutely a must. If they don't have those properly in a notice that you get from a debt collector, they have violated the law. That sets them up for an FDCPA lawsuit. However, a photocopy of Section 1692G is not a clear notice of the consumer's verification rights, since the language of the statute was not written to be understandable to unsophisticated consumers. The language of the verification notice must be substantively the same as the statutory language. In other words, if the language in a Dunning letter that you got isn't very, very similar to what's in 1692GA 1-5, there's probably a violation there. And I'll give you a couple case citations on that. There's a ton of them here. There's a whole list of them. One is Baker versus GC Services Corp. This is one that's mentioned quite a bit. That's from the Ninth Circuit in 1982. And then we have Bankston, B-A-N-K-S-T-O-N, v. Phycom, spelled P-H-Y-C-O-M, Corporation. That's Northern District of California, November of 07. And one more, Deacon, spelled D-I-K-U-N, v. Streich, S-T-R-E-I-C-H. That's the Eastern District of Virginia from 2005. Okay, the verification notice should be placed and written so as to effectively communicate verification rights to unsophisticated consumers. Always remember, every one of you, no matter how much you've studied here, you are an unsophisticated consumer. They have to assume that you are and treat you as an unsophisticated consumer. Always play the part. The debt collector should not contradict or obscure the notice of the consumer's right to verification with its conduct or statements. In other words, it has to be very plainly spelled out. They can't get fancy and kind of make up their own wording for this stuff. The notice must include the amount of the debt, the name of the current creditor, the debt collector's name and address, and believe it or not, each one of these sections here has got case citations in here. This is just incredible, and there's just too many of these things to read, but there's case citations for each one of these violations. A statement of the right to obtain the name of the original creditor, a statement that the debt collector will assume the debt is valid if the consumer does not dispute the debt or a portion of it in 30 days, and an explanation of the procedure for obtaining verification of the debt. And that in itself is important. The debt collector should not misstate on the verification notice the time the debtor has to request verification as 30 days from the date of the notice, rather than the statutorily required 30 days from the consumer's receipt of the notice. Please take note of that. It is 30 days from your receipt of the notice, not the date on the letter. Because if they used that, you'd have these debt collectors putting June 1st on there and they mail it on the 25th. It doesn't work that way. And who can testify to when you receive it? Only you, because they don't spend the money for certified mail or verified delivery. So if you have a dispute over that, that's where you use an affidavit. In addition, the FDCPA gives the consumer 30 days from the receipt of the notice to mail the request. It doesn't have to be back in their hands. It just has to be postmarked. And, of course, we always do our disputes by certified mail. That way we know they got them, and we also can verify the date that we mailed it and show to the court if there's a dispute at a future time that it was done timely. They don't do that because they don't have any means of proving whether they sent something to you or not. The collector may have violated the act by disclosing the name of the current creditor in a confusing shorthand fashion by using only its first name, Target, that the unsophisticated consumer would not recognize because it identifies several unrelated business entities with the same first name. For example, Target National Bank, Target Stores. The verification notice must state a writing is required from the consumer disputing the debt or requesting verification in order for debt verification to be required of the debt collector. Now, I want to touch on that because there's some people out there, I believe, that are mistakenly under the impression that if you have a conversation with a debt collector that they have to, and you tell them, I want you to validate the debt. You tell them that on the phone, that they're required to do so. That is incorrect. I'm going to read this sentence again. Please pay close attention. The verification notice must state a writing is required from the consumer disputing the debt or requesting verification in order for debt verification to be required of the debt collector. The verification notice must state that a portion of the debt may be disputed or verified. The notice may not state that the consumer must use a writing to dispute the debt to overcome the Section 1692G3 assumption by the debt collector that the debt is valid. 1692G3 says, if you don't dispute it within 30 days, they will assume that it is a valid debt. The consumer statement that, quote, I dispute the debt, unquote, is sufficient to dispute the validity of a debt under FDCPA. In other words, you don't have to write a book and say, you know, this and that and so on and so forth. Right here, quote, I dispute the debt, unquote, is sufficient to dispute the validity of a debt under FDCPA. I'm going to give you a case citation for that. Castro, C-A-S-T-R-O, versus ARS, National Services, Inc. That's from the Southern District of New York, March of 2000. So, you know, literally you could almost do a debt dispute with a fraction of a sentence. Four words. I dispute the debt. In Castro v. ARS, a district court in New York held that a debt collector violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act by including language in its verification notice that the least sophisticated consumer could read as imposing requirements beyond those set out in the FDCPA. According to the court, all that was needed to dispute the validity of a debt was a letter by the consumer with a statement, I dispute the debt. The debt collector's verification letter to the consumer stated six types of documents that the debt collector listed as suitable for dispute purposes, such as a canceled check or a final billing statement. The court found that by listing the examples, the least sophisticated consumer could reasonably conclude that some form of documentation was necessary to dispute the debt. The court further found that providing a list of, quote, suitable, unquote, documentation suggested that some types of documentation might be unsuitable, since all that is required under the FDCPA is a writing stating that all or a portion of a debt is disputed, a consumer need only send a letter stating, I dispute the debt, to dispute the debt. Because the letter could hamper a consumer's effort to communicate a dispute of a debt, the court held that the letter deprived the consumer of the statutory protection. In other words, it violated the law. Lawsuit. In DeSantis v. Computer Credit, Inc., and that's spelled D-E, capital S-A-N-T-I-S, versus Computer Credit, Inc., the Second Circuit found that a debt collector may not add the requirements that the consumer's request for verification contain a, quote, valid reason for non-payment, unquote. Computer Credit's letter to plaintiff conveyed a message that arguably interfered with a correct understanding of the message required by the Act. A recipient, especially if unsophisticated, might well have understood that the collector's obligation to obtain verification would arise only if the consumer prevented a valid reason for non-payment. That would be inconsistent with the required message. And that one, that's the Second Circuit, and that is that same case that I was just talking about, the DeSantis versus Computer Credit, excuse me. That is a Second Circuit 2001 decision. All right, here's another one. In McKinney versus, that's M-C, capital K-I-N-N-E-Y, versus Cattleway Properties, Inc., spelled C-A-D-L-E-W-A-Y, Properties, Inc., a divided panel of the Seventh Circuit held that a debt collector's request that the consumer confirm the amount of the debt collector's claim was not confusing and deceptive. The dissenting judge and the lower court believed that this was an unlawful impediment to the consumer exercising debt verification rights. However, the majority believed the confirmation would not be confusing and rejected the claim in the absence of expert evidence that a significant portion of unsophisticated consumers would be confused. Now, see, here's one that's a little bit contradictory, and this is one of the things that we're dealing with here on this validation issues and the both the information that the debt collectors send to us, as well as what we would request from them. The debt verification notice must contain the name of the current creditor to whom the debt is owed. It may be a violation to use a name for the creditor that is unfamiliar to the consumer or otherwise unclear. Okay, and I'm going to read you, let's see, go to the footnotes here. I'll give you a couple case citations on this. Let me read that sentence again. It may be a violation to use a name for the creditor that is unfamiliar to the consumer or otherwise unclear. And a case on that is Blarick, spelled B-L-A-R-E-K, versus Encore, spelled E-N-C-O-R-E, Receivable Management, Inc., and that is an Eastern District of Wisconsin case from March of 07. And there's a note in here I'll read behind that. Use of registered acronym, which consumers had never encountered before and could be confusing. All right, and then there's also Bode, B-O-D-E, versus same company, Encore Receivable Management. Like they had some problems with this. And that is Eastern District of Wisconsin. August of 07. And a note behind that, using similar name, Capital One Services, Inc., was not confusing. All right, and I'm going to give you one more on this. Deweese, spelled D-E-W-E-E-S. Versus Legal Servicing. And that's from the Eastern District of New York, 2007. I have somebody on the board, guest 23. Are these cases from the Poverty Law Center book? No, the Poverty Law Center doesn't do anything good. This is from the NCLC books, the National Consumer Law Center books, just to answer your questions. Okay, the note behind this case citation here was disclosure that debt had been, quote, assigned to this office, unquote, might convey that defendant had purchased debt and was confusing about identity of current creditor. Oh, now that's a good one. Again, the note here is disclosure that debt had been assigned to this office. And Leroy, if you're in here, that's a good one for you. Assigned to this office might convey that defendant had purchased debt and was confusing about identity to current creditor. Okay. Leroy's got a state case dealing with that up in Nebraska. All right, got to go back here. Notice of the right to obtain the name and address of the original creditor under Section 1692G(a)(5) need not be given if there was only one creditor. The Eighth Circuit would allow the debt collector to disclose the original creditors and their addresses and omit the offer to provide their name and address. In other words, the Eighth Circuit said they can go ahead and just put that stuff in there instead of saying, well, you can request it. In other words, saving people a step. The FTC once believed the information required by Section 1692GA3 and Section GA4 may be combined in a single overburdened sentence of the notice. That is not a good approach and is contradicted by the requirement the notice be effectively conveyed to the least sophisticated consumer. Remember, the comment here was the FTC once believed. The FTC does not make law. They can give opinion letters, but those are not binding in a court of law. An FTC staffer believed placing the word important on the verification notice labeled it sufficiently. The verification notice need not contain the date it was sent, although it may be better to include that date. The Sixth Circuit considered the collector's statement of information required by Section 1692GA3. All portions of this claim shall be assumed valid unless disputed within 30 days of receiving this notice. The court ruled even under the least sophisticated consumer standard, the language satisfied the act. And Greco versus Trauner, spelled G-R-E-C-O versus Trauner, T-R-A-U-N-E-R, Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, and Thomas, LLP. The Second Circuit held that the debt collector's addition to the debt verification notice that the creditor would also assume the debt was valid if consumer did not dispute debt in 30 days was not a violation of the FDCPA. The FDCPA does not require the debt collector to inform the consumer of the collector's obligation to stop collection that lasts until a requested verification has been provided, although they may disclose that requirement. The Second Circuit held that a letter that asserted that the collector and creditor would assume the debt to be valid in the absence of dispute did not violate Section 1692G by the addition of the reference to the creditor. See, it's these little things that added "and the creditor" in there. That didn't create a violation. One court held that the verification notice may omit a reference to the provision of a copy of a judgment if the debt had not been reduced to judgment. Okay, I'm going to read that again. One court held that the verification notice may omit a reference to the provision of a copy of a judgment if the debt had not been reduced to judgment. The FTC staff repeatedly warned collectors to delete the statutory references to judgment in Section 1692GA4 when there was no judgment against the consumer, as such reference was considered deceptive. Okay, let me look at the footnotes here. I'm going to give you, comments about the staff letters. There's no case citations there. I was wondering why we would have that. All right. Later, the FTC staff took the opposite tact. Okay. In Moore versus Ingram and Associates, that's M-O-O-R-E versus Ingram, I-N-G-R-A-M, and Associates, Inc., a court concluded that even the least sophisticated consumer would not be misled by use of the word judgment in the verification notice, even though a judgment had not been secured. And I've seen that numerous times in letters, and I must say, for me, it doesn't confuse me, so I can definitely go along with that. The right to dispute a portion of the debt was introduced in Senate Bill 3838 and not contained in some subsequent Senate bills. All right. Courts recommended additions to verification notice. Four appellate decisions have suggested additional language be added to verification rights notices to avoid confusion or deception when a debt collector is demanding immediate payment, threatening suit, or filing suit in the period of the consumer has the right to obtain verification of the debt. In Savino, spelled S-A-V-I-N-O, versus Computer Credit, Inc. The collection agent's violation of the FDCPA, quote, consisted of its decision to ask for immediate payment without also explaining that its demand did not override the consumer's rights under Section 1692G to seek verification of the debt. And that's obviously overshadowing. The court explained CCI could have both sought immediate payment and complied with the act simply by inserting into the text of its letter transitional language that referred to the addressee to the that referred the addressee to the validation notice. For example, CCI might have added one of the following paragraphs to its demand letter: although we have requested that you make immediate payment or provide a valid reason for non-payment, you still have the right to make a written request within 30 days of your receipt of this notice for more information about the debt. Your rights are described on the reverse side of this notice. Or this: the demand for immediate payment does not eliminate your right to dispute this debt within 30 days of receipt of this notice. If you choose to do so, we are required by law to cease our collection efforts until we have mailed that information to you. Your rights are described on the reverse side of this notice. In our view, the inclusion of this or similar language would effectively inform a consumer as to his or her rights under the FDCPA without imposing an undue burden on a debt collector's legitimate efforts to obtain the prompt payment of debts. In other words, they wouldn't have overshadowed. Overshadowing is what happens when you get into that and you don't give that information as that I just read. In Bartlett versus Heibel, spelled B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T, versus Heibel, spelled H-E-I, B.L. Judge Posner announced a safe haven debt verification notice for the Seventh Circuit where the letter threatened suit during the verification period. That safe haven language unfortunately has a legal error in it along with its good ideas. Now, I'm not going to read that whole thing because that's a long thing there that I don't believe is beneficial to all the listeners. While the model letter was by many salutary features, has many salutary features. Geez, I was going to say, wait a minute here. This my eyeball's failing me here. It fails to clearly inform the consumer that a dispute of a part of the debt, for example, a mysterious service charge, or the method by which the current balance was determined, triggers the obligation of the collector to validate that part of the debt. Such an omission would violate the FDCPA, at least in other circuits. In addition to clarifying that the collector would suspend or terminate collections if requested to validate a disputed debt, the Posner letter breaks up the notice of other aspects of the verification into simpler sentences, increasing its readability for unsophisticated consumers. In other words, if you've gotten a Dunning letter from somebody, if it's not crystal clear exactly what's meant by it, then you as an unsophisticated consumer are probably looking at a violation of the law. It also places the verification notice on the front of the letter following the description of the collector's stated collection activities, so that it's clear that the verification process will be followed if it is requested and the stated collection activities will be suspended or terminated. In Seventh Circuit in Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, versus Law Firm of Simpson and Cyback, C-Y-B-A-K, again took the precautionary step of suggesting how collection law firms could best provide the debt verification rights notice without confusing consumers if a debt collection suit was filed about the same time that the verification notice was provided. The court noted that the consumers might not understand that they had to respond to the summons to avoid a default judgment. While an amendment to the FDCPA overruled the main holding in Thomas, the court's advice regarding the notice may still be worth noting. The court recommended that collectors avoid that potential confusion altogether by sending the debt verification notice 30 days before suit, making it easier for consumers to understand that the requirements of the FDCPA and the summons are separate. That's very key to remember. You getting a summons is different than a Dunning letter. Where that was not possible, the court gave collectors in the Seventh Circuit sample language to add to the FDCPA debt verification notice that the court believes will reduce consumer confusion. All right. Now, the Second Circuit recently held that an FDCPA debt verification notice was overshadowed by the debt collector service of a collection lawsuit on the consumer during the 30-day verification request period, since the collector failed to explain or clarify in either the done or in a notice provided with the summons and complaint that the commencement of the lawsuit had no effect on the information conveyed in the debt verification notice. Let's see, this is dealing with a situation where they're sending these things up at the same time. And you got some of these law firms that do it. You know, they file hundreds of these things a week, these debt collection mills, just like the foreclosure mills. The court pointed out that Congress passed an FDCPA amendment in 06, adopting the court's reasoning that a debt verification notice must not be overshadowed by the debt collector's actions during the 30-day period the consumer may request verification. While the debt collector may continue some debt collection activities during that period, overshadowing activities would confuse a consumer about his rights. Remember, you are always a least sophisticated consumer, no matter how much of this you learn. Always put yourself in those shoes when you're dealing with these situations. You are the least sophisticated consumer. Use that benefit. The court reviewed several circuit court decisions, emphasizing that confusion was particularly likely with a summons issued to a consumer during the 30-day period to request verification. All right, I'm looking at something here. All right, the court noted that the easiest course for a debt collector was to simply wait. Here again, same thing. Was to simply wait until the end of the 30-day debt verification request period to serve a debt collection suit on the consumer. If the debt collector could not wait. The best practice would be to provide two more notices to the consumer. First should be with the initial verification rights and explain that the consumer's right to verification continues even if the debt collector sues the consumer during the 30-day request period. We've kind of covered that. It's repeated in here again. The second additional notice should be sent to the consumer at the time the summons and complaint is served and explain the consumer still has the right to obtain debt verification from the debt collector, and that the consumer additionally should respond appropriately in the state court as set out in the summons. The safe harbor established in the Second Circuit by this decision will not necessarily be adopted by other circuits. All right, now here's one that I actually circled and highlight here because it's one that I found to be very important. Notice that oral disputes overcome collector's assumption of validity of debt. That's 15 U.S.C. 1692 G.A.3. The verification notice should not state that the consumer must use a writing to dispute to raise a dispute that overcomes the Section 1692 G3 assumption by the debt collector that the debt is valid. The consumer is entitled to dispute a debt orally to overcome a collector's assumption that a debt is valid, although only a written dispute of the debt triggers the collector's duty to provide verification of the debt. Now, let's go back over that just very briefly. You can dispute a debt orally in a phone conversation with the debt collector. But if you want them to validate the debt, you can't just tell them that on the phone. You have to send them a written notice. I dispute this debt. Okay. In a recent ruling, the Ninth Circuit held in Camacho, C-A-M-A-C-H-O, that collectors who send out a debt verification notice cannot require that the consumer dispute the debt only in writing. Okay, I'm going to give you a case citation here. That one is Camacho versus Bridgeport, B-R-I-D-G-E, P-O-R-T, Finance, Incorporated. That's a Ninth Circuit decision from 2005. Instead, the consumer's oral notification is sufficient to overcome the debt collector Section 1692GA assumption, GA3 assumption that the debt is valid, even though a written request is required to obtain verification of the debt or a response to the dispute. Instead, the consumer can dispute the debt's validity in writing or orally. Again, I want to emphasize, you can dispute the validity of the debt in writing or orally in a conversation to get validation that must be requested in writing. You cannot request validation orally. In reaching this conclusion, the Ninth Circuit noted that there are at least three other FDCPA provisions in addition to Section 92GA3 requiring only oral notice by the consumer. Notification that the debt is disputed, requiring the collector to include that fact when communicating the debtor's credit information to others, including credit reporting agencies. Okay. And you can do that orally. where a in the next one out of the three is where a consumer has multiple debts, a payment cannot be applied to a debt which the consumer has notified the collector is in dispute. And the third one is notification that a time or place is inconvenient to the consumer for communication from the collector. Camacho disagreed with Graziano, G-R-A-Z-I-A-N-O, an older decision from the Third Circuit, which ruled that all consumers' disputes under Section 1692G must be in writing. It is the case that certain FDCPA rights are only triggered by written notice, such as under sections G, A, 4, and 5, and 92C and parens C. A consumer's notice that a debt is disputed under section 92G, A, 4 must be in writing if it is to require the debt collector to cease collecting the debt until it provides the consumer a verification of the debt that it is in response to the dispute. The Ninth Circuit held that the fact that these provisions require written notice will not be exposed on other provisions which did not expressly require written notice. In Camacho, the Ninth Circuit followed the lead of the U.S. Supreme Court that the courts should not insert language into a statute unless the failure to do so resulted in absurd or unreasonable results. It also looked to another Supreme Court case stating, quote, where Congress includes particular language in one section of a statute but omits it in another section of the same act, it is generally presumed that Congress acts intentionally and purposely in the disparate inclusion or exclusion, unquote. In other words, they're being very specific. All right, how are we doing time here? I'm going to go on a little bit more here, and then we're going to wrap it for today. Because other sections of the FDCPA require debt collectors to listen to consumers' oral disputes, the court reasoned it would not be absurd for Congress to require them to do so in Section 92GA3. This is a particularly important holding for consumers because of the increasing number of mistakes by collection agencies and debt buyers in collecting bills that have been paid, are time-barred, are only owed by another consumer, were fraudulent, or were discharged in bankruptcy. If a consumer orally disputes a debt, the debt collector must note it in any report it makes to a credit reporting agency or risk FDCPA liability under Section 1692E8. All right, remember that. When you dispute to a debt collector, even if you just dispute it orally, and they do not convey the fact that it's been disputed to the credit reporting agency, you have an FDCPA violation under 1692E8. A verification notice, therefore, violated the FDCPA when it stated that the debt would be presumed valid unless the consumer disputed it in writing. The Ninth Circuit in Camacho disagreed with the Third Circuit's opposite result in Graziano. In Graziano, the Third Circuit held, we therefore conclude that subsection A3, like subsections A4 and A5, contemplates that any dispute to be effective must be in writing. Get used to doing all these things in writing. Even if you have a conversation with these people on the phone, always make sure that you send them a debt validation letter. And if nothing else in that letter, just four words. I dispute this debt. And I gave you a case citation to back that up. The Camacho decision and the plain meaning of Section 1692GA may result in other circuits disagreeing with the Third Circuit on this point. District courts have rejected Graziano, noting that it failed to give effect to the plain language of the statute. A First Circuit decision, Brady versus Credit Recovery Company. Again, that's Brady versus Credit Recovery Company. You may wonder why I take the time and give you this information, because you should go and look at these cases and read these things. Look them up. Google these things. This is how you learn about these fine points, and you gain the keep track of these cases, so that when you have an argument, you have these case citations to use to your benefit, and you don't have to go chasing them later on. That's why I take this time. The First Circuit decision, Brady versus Credit Recovery Company, illustrated the utility of providing this disclosure. In Brady, the consumer orally contested the debt, and the collector violated Section 1692E8 by failing to include the fact of the consumer's dispute in its report of the debt to a credit reporting agency. And don't we work all the time with violations of what's going on with the credit reporting agencies? If they don't show it as disputed, there's a violation. However, one court has held that a debt collector is not required to provide debtors with a telephone number in order to assist debtors in disputing the debt orally. Now, I don't think that's a big deal myself. Fortunately, phone numbers have become easier to find on state debt collection licensing and complaint websites. A bill introduced in a prior Congress would have added the requirement that the consumer's dispute must be in writing to overcome the collector Section 92GA3 assumption of validity. News of these and other developments may be obtained from NCLC Reports, Debt Collection and Repossessions Edition, between annual supplements of this treatise. All right, I am going to call it there for tonight.